So speak up, because we're near But, you know, since there were significant changes after the public comment period, you know, who knows what everybody's going to think about that. Let's see.
You know that?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Lowry.
You're not being very effective. There's still all these. Go back again and tell them to sit down.
I wonder if we could ask Fred Lowry to sit down. He's so busy talking. We've been, as you know, we've been concerned and discussing the issue of the use of residual dried blood spots for quite a long time. And as you know, the May report on residual dried blood spots was posted for public comment. There were a large number of public comments received. And today, Alyssa Johnson is coming back, having been through all those comments. As a matter of fact, I've read all the comments also, and I'm sure others have. And she has basically analyzed the public comments and has looked at those, worked with other various and sundry members of the staff to try to incorporate those as appropriate into the report. And so Alyssa's going to tell us about the public comments and how she has put those. And I think the group knows Alyssa. She's been with us a number of times. She has a lot of experience in public policy research and so forth. And so we are delighted to have you back, Alyssa.
Thank you for having me back. And first, I will say that probably Lisa Vasquez and Michelle did much delving through all of the public comments, and Lisa sorted them out for me. So, and she has put together a few slides that I'm going to run through first on exactly some statistics about the comments. And then we'll go through subsequent changes that were made to the paper based on those public comments, based on two lengthy calls with the residual dry blood spot working group, so I want to thank them for their input, and based on, you know, the thoughts of HRSA staff. So as far as the public comments, approximately 550 individuals submitted email comments and responses and reactions, and 13 organizations submitted comments. Lisa has put together some specific concerns and interpretations from some of the individual comments. Number one reaction is recommends the committee simply develop national guidance for consent or dissent for the secondary use of specimens. And we did have individual as well as organizational comments about consent and dissent options, so we'll discuss that further later. Number two asserts a public claim on the DNA of newborn citizens. And I think there were numerous comments similar to that. Claims that newborn blood is necessary for population surveillance. Number four, claims that newborn screening test development is not research. Number five, claims that state screening programs are charged with stewardship of newborn DNA samples, ensuring appropriate use rather than charged with simply testing each newborn. Number six, fails to recommend informed written consent requirements for the storage and use of newborn DNA for research and other purposes. Number seven, does not support the 22 state genetic privacy laws and the 5 state genetic ownership laws that may or do require consent. Number eight, does not include public opinion data from the University of Michigan study regarding unconsented storage and research. And number nine, recommends parent education instead of informed parent consent requirements that will enforce such education. And just summarizing the general tone of that, the interpretation that the recommendations for the storage and use of newborn DNA do not acknowledge the consent, privacy, parent, and DNA property rights of the individual. There was a tone that the belief that the committee is advocating for the expansion of government power over the individual's most intimate property. Opinion that the recommendations advocate for the reduction of constitutional rights of individual citizens and, as proposed, do not comply with the legal individual rights and informed written consent requirements as secured by the Fourth Amendment privacy and property protections. And lastly, perception that the committee seeks to establish and support government banking and ownership of citizen DNA at birth through the creation of 50 state government DNA warehouses for nationwide genetic research on the American public without the informed written consent of citizens. And so we did try to take the tone of those comments into account, and we did make some efforts to reorganize and rename sections of the paper to try to highlight the areas of the paper that do address those kind of issues, as I will show you later. These are the organizational comments that we received. If you want to just take a look, I won't bore you with reading through all of those. And we'll go ahead and start through the edits to the paper. If you do have the briefing book up on your computer, those of you that have one, I do have the page numbers on there, and that's should match the page number that you have in the briefing book copy of the paper. And I also wanted to point out, we've been having some issues with passing the document back and forth, and again, when the briefing paper was converted to this PDF format, there are some oddities. For instance, there's some bolded text that's bolded and italicized in the recommendations. That's not intended emphasis. And there are some boxes that appear, so I ask you to please disregard that. When the paper does go to the secretary, I will be spending the day at HRSA and meticulously going through it, making sure that it's not converted to another format, so all of that will not appear in the final format. To start with, for the introduction, we did some rewording there. The Secretary's Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children encourages an approach to the guidance that, and this is the change that I'd like to highlight, maintains the standard uses of the residual blood specimens by newborn screening programs and upholds the core principles of benefiting infants, families, and society, et cetera. We did in several places in the paper, as we'll discuss further later, add language referring to standard uses of residual blood specimens and made an attempt to lay out what the standard uses were versus other uses. And I think that this comment is in part in line with some of the concerns that March of Dimes had also, that these recommendations wouldn't harm the regular program activities of newborn screening programs. Also in the introductions, the recommendations related to the retention and use of residual dry blood spot specimens are intended to work in concert with and not to weaken long-standing and highly effective state newborn screening programs. And that change, again, was made based on comments we had received from the March of Dimes. And we did, as I mentioned earlier, go through these comments with the residual blood spot working groups and get their input. There were some sections that were renamed, as I stated earlier, and reordered just for what we felt was better organization of the paper. So now there are sections on international policy, federal policy, and state policy under the ethical, legal, and social issues. And there were sections were renamed on engaging the providers and the public and engaging the public trust through empowerment. And we thought that might highlight areas where the paper responds to public concerns and comments around those issues. On pages 6 and 7 of the briefing book, you can see the standard newborn screening program uses of residual dry blood specimens that we laid out. Program evaluation and quality assurance is one, treatment efficacy, test refinement, and result verification. And I don't know if at this point it's fine if anyone has any comments on that. Do we want to hold to the end or, okay?
No, I
go ahead and.
No, ask for comments.
Yeah, does anybody want to go ahead and comment? on that? No, okay. And then as laid out, other uses, new test development, population surveillance, parental request for other testing, family requested identifications of remains and research. And in particular, the parental request for other testing, right now we have that under other uses. I want to make sure that you want it there and not under standard uses. Then on page 6, we also outlined the two principal purposes of the paper, and that was based on a comment from NIH. They thought that would be helpful. So now the language states, the first purpose is to review the issues facing state newborn screening programs related to the retention and use of residual dried blood spot specimens. And we, after that, it had said research, it had initially said research use, or including potential research use. And after talking with the residual dry blood spot working group, we decided to remove that and just say retention and use generally. And then the second purpose is to lay the foundation for developing national guidance to states in this area, which is similar to what we had previously. On page 7, because newborn screening specimens are usually the first blood specimen drawn in a baby's life, they represent a unique time frame where, and this is what we changed based on the working group's comments, most influences, whereas before it said were influences, on the contents of the blood are in utero exposures. Then moving on to page 9, the section on GINA, and this was based on comments from the Genetic Alliance. We added a sentence that greater public understanding of the protections mandated by GINA could mitigate parents, I'm sorry, there seems a problem with the apostrophe there, concerns about possible risk of genetic discrimination if their children's blood spots are retained. And that, I think, responds in part to some of the individual public comments as well. On page 11, a section was on the voluntary national repository was expanded. New language includes one method for establishing a voluntary repository under discussion that could be accomplished without the collection of de novo specimens involves the use of a newborn screening biobanks to develop a national newborn research biobank. There are challenges to the establishment of any non-newborn screening repository comprising residual newborn screening specimens, and significant issues would need to be addressed, including variations in state law, regulation, and policy, and I think it's the latter sentence that you would want to focus on more. And that was done in also with help with Ann Como. We talked to her a significant bit about that issue. Also on the section on voluntary national repository, there was a sentence removed with reference to the National Children's Study. And that was done based on the working group discussion that there may be some question of where things are at there as far as whether that was a good example to put as the National Children's Study providing the impetus for a U.S. national biobank based on similar hypotheses. So that sentence was removed. The section on national IRB, a locally structured IRB lacking public health expertise may not suffice to serve a national biorepository being used for public health research. That sentence was added also based on our discussions with Dr. Como. On page 13, the section on state laws and regulations, there was a reference added to the new table that is in the paper on state statutes and regulations on the storage and use in residual dry blood specimens, and the reference was removed to examples of state forms. If you recall, we had a few examples of forms in there from various states. I believe South Carolina was one. We decided to remove those examples and add the statutes and regulations, and so a search for that was done in July, and we're going to update that table again before we send it to the secretary. And I can mention here, we also did, in response to the comments, go through some of the consent or opt-in and opt-out forms. We looked at Denmark, we looked at Michigan and try to develop possibly sample opt-in and opt-out forms and put together something to add to the appendix. And then we did have a conference call with the working group, and at that time it was decided that providing these sample opt-in and opt-out forms in the absence of educational materials really was not that useful at this time. But there has been some work done related to that issue, and obviously there were many comments received related to that issue. And the working group at one point did suggest the possibility of maybe there should be an ad hoc group who can go ahead and start looking at these consent and dissent issues, but that it wasn't work to be done necessarily in this paper, that it's something that could be done at a later date.
And can I say something?
Sure.
This was a really strong recommendation to have that those kinds of model policies from NIH. They really have two times asked for this within this briefing paper. So the committee and the NIH representative or member is not here today, but I think the committee should be cognizant of that and be ready to respond to NIH.
Yes.
I'm not sure if this is the right place to bring this up, but it mm-hmm. occurred to me as I was reading this section last night. I really like what's been said about the ownership of the original samples themselves, but something that comes up frequently is what about the amplicons from the samples? Mm-hmm. When you take somebody's DNA and you're now doing nucleic acid amplification mm-hmm. tests like PCR, you are duplicating, replicating millions of copies of a piece of the patient's sample. So at some point we're going to need to address whether ownership of the original sample extends to amplicons and derivatives of those nucleic acids or not.
Right. And we did have on the, I agree with you, and that's not something that we've talked about at all at this point. And actually one of the comments that we had from Vanderbilt was to get away from the whole ownership issue. And we did have a discussion in the working group conference call. There was a suggestion to remove the title ownership entirely and just change it to authority over decision making. That ownership might be, you know, sort of a not the best way to word it. And the working group just said that we should put that out to you all and see what you'd like to do. But that raises a good point. But I don't know if
Alan, you have a comment on that.
My comment actually was back to Michelle's request for clarification about the NIH's request, and I think that in the recommendation 7, which relates directly to this issue, there's a request of the Secretary to improve efforts to facilitate a national dialogue among federal and state stakeholders and develop some models. It's not that we have neglected their concern. The question is it ripe for prescription? And I think that's that we have not done the necessary work to give the states those recommendations, even though they'd like them and we'd like to have done that work, but we haven't. So there's going to be the need for additional work in order to clarify this area. It's not that we disagree with the need for that outcome.
Thank you, Dr. Plaster. And that was the discussion during the working group call that everyone agreed upon, so at that point. And as I just alluded to on the section on ownership, we did make some changes there referring to who has the authority to make decisions, changing that from ownership previously. So it said uncertainty about ownership before, but we changed it to who has the authority to make decisions, but we kept the section titled ownership. So if you'd like to remove reference to ownership for that as well, please let me know. I mean, you can see that the individual comments, the feelings about the word, you know, ownership were quite strong.
Well, one of the comments is it says ownership and then it doesn't mention it in the rest of the parts, so.
I'm sorry, on the section
about. When you look at the section on ownership,
Right.
And the rest of the discussion doesn't even touch ownership. It talks about authority and things like that. So I think
right now the section is titled ownership, and this sentence is in there, and before it said, prior to this change, nonetheless, potential uncertainty about ownership with regard to specimens, and we reworded it as suggested to say potential uncertainty about who has the authority to make decisions. Because ownership is clearly an issue in some states in that they do have, you know, genetic privacy laws that include personal property rights to DNA, but and it is an issue in that, you know, some state newborn screening programs, you know, have declared that they own the specimens. And the related genetic privacy laws have come out, you know, in lawsuits and so forth. So it's a matter of whether you want to steer clear of that ownership language or not.
Michelle has a question.
Sure.
This is to the committee so that we're not deciding things ourselves. Right. So, Alan, for one, the reason why I brought up the issue of the NIH recommendation, the committee needs to decide. We made this decision, the work group made this decision. Does the committee agree with that decision not to have any model policies? I think it is addressed in the recommendation, but as for ownership, we need to decide now whether or not that title is appropriate. In fact, that paragraph does talk about ownership issues, and ownership is mentioned 3 or 4 times in that paragraph. If you read the brief, in some programs, state statutes or regulations define ownership, okay, of the specimen. But it ends with this last sentence, and the brief does give some examples of different laws. Nonetheless, potential uncertainty about who has the authority to make decisions. That's the end. So it is talked about ownership, and there's several other areas under that section that talk about ownership. The point is between ownership and stewardship, the public health community of those that provided input thought framing the role of the state public health programs who have oversight responsibility of the newborn screening program, like the concept of stewardship, although their state laws may define ownership, that they feel they have a stewardship responsibility, all programs do, feel that responsibility to take care of the newborn screening programs. So.
Jerry.
I think it would be a mistake to remove the word ownership from this policy paper, because that's the word that's out there, and we're addressing not only a commonly invoked piece of public perception, but also direct language in several state statutes. So I think to ignore it is to ignore the elephant in the room. But I do like the way it ends up being redefined to authority to make decision, because I think that's the more correct ultimate piece that we're getting to. And so I would just leave the title of that section ownership and continue moving it to try to be a little bit less inflammatory, which is, I think ownership is inflammatory. Authority to make decisions brings it down to what we really want to say.
I think that's well put. Jeff?
Yeah, I want to agree with that, and perhaps just suggest that I think the main problem is people look at the concept of ownership and think that that means you can do anything you might want with the sample. So the qualifiers that are included here about the authority to make decisions, I think highlights the fact that ownership is a complicated term, means a variety of different things depending on the context. So maybe that sort of qualifier phrase ought to move up to the front of the paragraph here so that readers understand at that point that ownership, we understand ownership to be a complicated phenomenon, but we don't want to avoid the word because it's so commonly used in this domain.
So you would begin the paragraph with this document, take out nonetheless, but start with potential start with potential uncertainty and then have the section on the state laws and so forth.
And we might even simply say right at the very beginning, the word ownership is a complicated term that means a variety of things. What we're concerned about, who has the authority to make decisions about the management of these samples.
I think that's the sense that I get that I see. Sharon?
I would take it a little farther and say not only is it a complicated term, but that actually its legal ramifications vary from state to state, and the contractual arrangement between the state and the individual is different. And certainly doesn't have to be that as complicated as I just said it, but I think more than just saying it's a term, I think we should also allow that it's associated with a legal connotation. And that should be explicit so that we're not later challenged to say that actually has legal meaning.
Right, right. That sounds sensible. Any further comments for Alyssa on that point? I think the sense of the committee.
I think just starting out that way would be good, and ownership is one way in which to handle who has authority to make decisions.
Okay. Very good.
With reference to the section on the Michigan BioTrust for Health, pages 14 and 15, and then the appendix, changes were made, and that was based on information that was provided by the Michigan Department of Community Health. And the discussion of the Denmark Biobank, that was not changed. It was just moved into a text box, which is called Denmark and International Perspective, and that was placed in the sections on state policies on the storage of residual dried blood specimens. It just seemed to be the most appropriate fit there.
I like that. It sits in a box. It has the information there, but it kind of segregates it as information that's independent of the discussion.
Yeah, it didn't fit well into international policy.
I think you're correct.
Okay. The section on consent and dissent, we did add a few sentences there in response to the comments, and like I said, we did put forth some examples that we decided to hold off on and not put in the appendix at this time. A new paragraph was added, page 18. Newborn screening programs may utilize several methods to provide parents or guardians with alternatives regarding specimen storage and use. The alternatives involved an opt-in or opt-out process whereby individuals are informed of the potential storage and use of specimens, and either one of the following occurs. First, a newborn specimen is not stored or available for allowable approved uses after screening is complete unless the parent opts into the biobank. Parental consent is sought and possibly formalized through a signed document. Or, number two, a newborn specimen is stored and available for allowable approved uses unless the parent guardian objects or indicates dissent, and we did add a reference. The decision to opt out also may be formalized through a signed document. Longitudinal studies of children who eventually transition to adulthood should retain some degree of flexibility to account for the decision-making authority of children as compared to adults. So that's all language that you have not seen before. Does anyone have any comments on that?
Nope.
Okay. Moving to the conclusion, there were some sentences that were reworded on page 23 of the briefing book. Nevertheless, aspects of the current public policy environment, including differing or lacking state policies on the need for explicit consent, and that refers to the explanation that was earlier in the paper, or dissent, potential uncertainty about authority over decision making with regard to residual newborn screening specimens in state without a well-defined policy and minimal public awareness of newborn screening send an unclear message to the public about the purpose of storage and use of residual blood specimens. And I think in particular we added the language regarding consent and dissent and changed the end of the sentence to say that this does send an unclear message to the public, and I think maybe that's apparent from the individual comments that were received on the paper. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Also in the conclusion, there were a couple sentences that were reworded. This has engendered some public concern about the storage of residual newborn screening specimens, even for standard newborn screening program uses, and that just refers back to the standard uses that we laid out earlier in the paper. And the storage and use of residual blood specimens for non-standard uses, such as research, may not be adequately addressed in current state laws or policies. So the emphasis there is on standard uses versus non-standard uses. Also in the conclusion, policies developed for the storage and use of residual dried blood specimens for research should not harm long-standing and highly effective state newborn screening programs, including their ability to store and use specimens for program activities, and that's in partial response to the March of Dimes comments as well. Rather, these policies should strengthen these well, and we should take out a these there. I see, I feel like that's too many these. These policies should strengthen these well-established public health programs through increased public education and engagement. I think at this time, maybe we can move on to the recommendations. So on page 24, the more detailed explanations of the recommendations that were under the initial, the first sentence of the recommendations, we did remove those from the executive summary. So you just have one brief sentence about the recommendations in the executive summary now, and then the further explanation is in the body of the paper. Oh. There we go. The as far as recommendation one, the explanation of that recommendation was shortened, and a sentence about access to policies was added, and it was shortened in the explanation was shortened based on the HRSA staff felt it was a bit repetitive, and then the sentence about access to policies was added based on comments from the Genetic Alliance that we emphasized that these policies should be accessible. In recommendation two, standard uses provided in and sentence, that doesn't make sense to me, regarding access to policies added to recommendation two. Not sure what the provided is, but we did add standard uses and access to policies. Recommendation three, potential use for research was changed to potential uses because we were concerned about all potential uses, perhaps in the recommendation, not necessarily focusing on research. Educational programs should focus on prenatal care providers as the primary target. Education of postnatal care providers should instruct them to follow up on prenatal educational efforts, et cetera. So the new, the changed language is that which is italicized and bolded there. And that was also based on comments from the Genetic Alliance that we should emphasize that the prenatal care providers are the primary target, although the postnatal care providers definitely have a role to play. And that, actually it's a duplicate slide, but there's, if you just look at the last item on there, the first two are duplicates of the previous. Reference to prenatal care providers being primarily responsible for parental education was also added to recommendation five. On recommendation six and seven, those were separated and reworded to explain the goals of the recommendation and make those the primary focus. So those were improved education and facilitating a national dialogue rather than requesting funding to support these activities. If you recall before, it stated the advisory committee recommends that the secretary provide administrative funding and support for education and then to facilitate a national dialogue, and we separated those out to try to better explain ourselves for why we thought that should be the case. And then recommendation eight is an entirely new recommendation. And this recommendation states that the Secretary of Health and Human Services should explore the utility and feasibility of establishing a voluntary national repository. And the comment with regard to the repository, those were received from the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Genetics, Health, and Society.
And NIH.
And NIH, okay. Further explanation of recommendation eight, it states to implement this recommendation, the committee recommends that the secretary instruct and provide additional funding for NIH and CDC in consultation with OHRP and other relevant federal agencies and non-governmental organizations to draft policies and guidelines addressing the support and maintenance of the repository. Issues to be addressed include stewardship of the collection, establishment of oversight systems and national human subjects review structure, access and retention policies, and how legal and ethical issues would be addressed, including variations in state laws. So So do we want, before we move on to this, do we want to discuss that?
I'm wondering whether the voluntary term needs more discussion here. Is it clear enough that it's voluntary with respect to the parents of the kids as opposed to voluntary with respect to state programs?
I'm not completely clear about your question, Jeff.
Well, I guess the rest of the explanation doesn't really describe what we mean by voluntary. And I assume what we mean is that parents have agreed to have their samples included in a national repository. Is that what the voluntary term means?
I think that was the intent, and I see what you're saying. Not voluntary by the state newborn screening programs to opt in everybody in their state. It's voluntary on the part of the individual.
That should be clarified. It certainly, I think it was clearly the intent that it's voluntary on the part of the parent or the guardian. So maybe that can be clarified. Good. Jane?
Alyssa, I noticed that APHL is not listed in the organizations that provided comments on the paper. And I know that we did, in fact, provide like five pages. Were those incorporated, or what became of those?
We did have APHL comments several rounds before.
But not during the official public comment period. So the first recommendation.
So
They were.
And I think I have email from you that we exchange laying out how it is. So I'll find it and send it to you just to make sure. But they were. That was one or two meetings ago, and that was done.
But yet they didn't come back with comments, or we didn't receive them, if they did.
We have a comment from Jaleli about that question.
I just wanted to be clear, Lisa, we did provide comments to you five pages in January during the
conference. Right.
Yes.
And those were all addressed at that time.
But it wasn't, have they been addressed in that particular document up here?
Right.
The recent revised document.
Well, we sent out the revised document before this one for public comment in May. And we did not receive any public comments from APHL at that time as an organization.
But I don't know that the paper would be so different at this time that than when you had commented on it in January.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, you're right. So you provided comments, but I don't think the paper changed that significantly since they provided comments.
But the point is the comments were provided before the May document and so forth. And we're delighted that Jaleli is here and not being held hostage as his partners across the street were recently. Please.
Okay. So if we have...
Mike has some questions.
I'm sorry, I was asleep at the switch when you went by... Page 11. Did somebody catch the omission of the word improvement under CLIA on page 11? It says the clinical laboratory amendments of 1988 CLIA should be the clinical laboratory improvement amendment. And then under the CLIA Act, the word improvement was also eliminated or omitted in the name of the clinical laboratory improvement advisory.
Okay. So if you'll get that improvement in there.
I just happened to notice it last
time. We always want to improve the laboratories any way we can.
Yeah. Like I said, I will be going through this with a fine-tooth comb before at HRSA, before the paper is submitted. And also, this section that I'm going to talk about now, we will be updating it again. So do we want to go ahead and move on to the state statutes and regulations?
Yes.
Okay.
Can I just make a...
Sure.
Chris has a comment.
Yeah, you had the, if you put the one up where you said primary target of education, I always trouble with that,
here.
As opposed to focus educational efforts on the prenatal care, primary target bothers me, but if it doesn't bother other folks.
Focus?
Yeah, focus educational efforts on them as primary target just
sounds. Yeah. Belligerent.
So just end at providers.
Audience?
We could just end at providers.
No,
educational programs focus should focus on prenatal care.
No, as long as you
say
you should focus
it's
on primary.
Target.
It's target, primary target. Just
so we could just end at providers.
Yeah.
Period.
should primarily focus was the suggestion here. Does everyone like that?
If you put primarily before target. Should.
It's primarily should focus, and I do that, but then people don't like it. I know. Yes.
We've converted that to a less belligerent statement.
Okay.
But it's going to keep target's going to go off. Primary target's going to go
off. We're going to say educational programs primarily should focus on prenatal care providers, period.
That's good. I like that.
Is that okay, Mary?
Mary, did you like target?
Well, that's what that is. And that's why we did debate here.
Okay. So we will go on to this. So you have the table lays out all of the state statutes and regulations on storage and use. And I will, if you see the asterisk there, the table is merely on state policies that refer to storage and use of information or test results only without specifically discussing specimens. What is happening with this? State policies that refer to storage and use of information or test results only, or without specifically discussing specimens, and genetic privacy law is not included. I don't like how that's worded. But the intent is, we actually worked through this, Brad and I, so thank you for helping me, but we want to be sure that people understand that if the policy merely says you can store a specimen for 21 years, it's not included. Only if it says how you can use that specimen in addition is it included. This is not intended to cover genetic privacy laws that may apply. So we will reword that.
If we know of others that you don't have listed, you want us to tell you later about those?
On the table?
Yeah, I mean, you could add Oregon, that we do have a law that relates to this.
This has happened to me with Oregon before.
It's been on the books
for
a long time. It was brought forward by the Catholic Conference in the mid-1990s, and it just says that you can't use these to do complete genetic testing of everyone, or it actually relates to.
Well, is it now, see, are you talking about, though, the genetic privacy law?
No, I'm talking about a rule in the newborn screen. Actually, it's a statute, part of the newborn screening statute. I'll tell you later.
Okay. But I've read, I did read through all the newborn screening statutes, so I'd definitely be interested, and the regulations, and that's why I tend to, based on my experience at NCSL, always put at least. But you'll always be foiled. And as you can see there is a brief that was prepared for the IOM, and as an example of what happens, I read through all the statutes and regulations in late April, and we wrote the brief in early May, and sure enough, a bill that had passed one chamber of the Oklahoma legislature in that time by the meeting had passed the other chamber and was signed by the governor. And since that meeting, there's also been another new regulation in Indiana. So as of August 2010, and that was early August, state statutes or regulations were found in 19 states, and I'll discuss with you Oregon later, that discuss storage and use issues to some degree. And you have a list there of the states that I found. And I'm sorry, I had said Indiana. It's Idaho in July 2010. These are some just recent changes that have occurred in the last 3 months. Has a new regulation now that states use is limited to routine calibration of newborn screening lab equipment and quality assurance. And for other uses, the express written consent of parent guardian is required. The storage period is up to 18 months, and retesting a specimen in the event of a symptomatic diagnosis or death is permitted. Another example of a recent change, the governor signed a bill in May of this year in Oklahoma that a laboratory, medical facility, hospital, or birthing place is prohibited from the unauthorized storage, transferring, use, or databasing of DNA of any newborn child without express parental consent. And there was actually already a regulation there that said that the health department had authority over storage and use of the form kits. So this really just changes that there has to be parental consent to do so. And I actually did confirm with the program there, because I think it's interesting to note that this doesn't actually state newborn screening blood specimens in the text. I wanted to be sure that was the intent, was to address those. I wanted to give some examples of some state websites on storage and use policies, because we did add to the paper in the recommendations that people should be able to access these policies. And if you want to take a look, maybe, I don't know if I can click on it here, at the Minnesota website, but they do lay out newborn screening studies that have been done. No, it's not going to let me do that. And non-newborn screening studies. So they have a pretty informative page there. And then also in Texas, there's information available on studies from dating back to 2001. So you may want to take a look at that as well. And that, I believe, covers it.
Kelly has a comment.
Yes. If we could go back to the section about education, I just wanted to question as to the question why the education is going to be focused on providers and not expectant parents, and that the primary target should indeed be the people who are going to be consenting or not consenting to storage and use.
Yeah, well, we have the
educational programs should focus on prenatal care providers and patients.
There's a separate recommendation for, let me read back, for consumer education.
But, okay, but that's not what it says in the section, so it's a little confusing.
Okay.
Thank you.
A general question, and that is that you have gone through the public comments with a fine-tooth comb, and are there any substantive comments from the major organizations such as the March of Dimes or the NIH or CDC that were felt not appropriate to incorporate in the document?
I think the biggest issues would be what we've gone back to about whether there should be a model consent or dissent included in the paper.
And can you tell us the comments about that from the various, what were the specific recommendations from the organizations?
Sure, I can. Hold on. I can bring them up right now. I can read them to you. Hold on just one second.
Many of the public comments that I read came from a similar geographic
right.
area and were very similar in content.
It would be, so referring to consent and dissent?
Yes.
Yes. It would be, these are from NIH. It would be helpful to provide a more complete discussion of opt-in, opt-out approaches to consent, discuss mechanisms to ensure privacy and confidentiality. They also make a reference to human subjects, further discussion of human subjects regulations, but we thought that we did do that and had run this by OHRP. And the paper would also benefit from the use of standard definitions and consistent terminology. And we did add the standard uses explanation, and we do have some definitions in there as far as types of information. Just said that it would be a more useful educational tool. We were too.
I'm going to address the CDC comments before Roger talks.
And Michelle is going to make some comments about the CDC.
We received right. CDC comments about 3 weeks before this meeting. I think that's Colleen there. Is that about
yeah.
right? Yeah. So we included in the briefing book, and they're right after the briefing paper. And I can go through them. One is to consider the IOM, if you remember, the committee had, or the chair, and the roundtable had encouraged the Institute of Medicine to conduct hold a workshop on the use and storage of residual blood spots for translational research. And this was an effort to have wide public comments received, organizational, but more importantly, public comments. We were interested in that, to have a forum for that. And it's out now. We have a, in your supplement briefing package, there the pre-publication copy of the summary from the IOWN workshop is included. Jeff Botkin actually was one of the editors. I spoke with Alyssa now before this presentation and said we should go through it and see if we can include some of the parts from that workshop. I would like to include, for example, Ann Como's presentation gave a really detailed example of how she used the residual blood spots to develop a test for SCID within the state. We mentioned that, but the detail, I think, is in the workshop summary is good to include. The if everybody agrees, so we need to agree now for some of this stuff so that we don't have to come back in January. CDC recommends that includes a recommendation that all newborn screening programs should have policies addressing the disposition, access, and use of residual dry blood spots specimens as an urgent need for federal guidance. And through partnerships, I'm going to skip over the entire statement from CDC. Through partnerships, CDC has partnered in formulating model menu best practice provisions for legislative aspects of other public health programs and could partner with stakeholders to develop the guidance. And they were already included in the last recommendation, so we thought we had addressed that recommendation. Colleen, if you don't think so, we need to hear now. CDC also has extensive experience in producing and implementing health communication education campaigns to inform the public. CDC would like to join HRSA and MCHB in this effort. To provide this flexibility, we suggest that specific references to funded agency in recommendation 7 be deleted. We deleted it in the recommendation, but we included, we kept the explanation. We didn't change the explanation. Discussions of potential uses of residual dry blood specimens often lump activities that have a diverse set of issues. And for example, the label research, which can evoke concerns in privacy, particularly inappropriate disclosure of medical information, may be applied to the use of dry blood specimens for program development. And she's going through what we would consider standard program uses. We thought we addressed this by actually defining what standard program uses are, more distinctly by having that box and distinguishing between standard program uses, other uses, and research uses.
So just one comment there, Michelle.
Uh-huh.
And Alyssa, when going through it on page 7.
I can't go back and forth. So.
Oh, sorry. But on page 7 where you have the uses, other uses, I thought it might be useful to say which ones could be done within the context of anonymized samples versus not. I mean, because the examples that you actually give are those. I mean, there's many uses of dried blood spots.
Colleen, we can't hear you clearly.
I'm sorry. I said there's many uses of dried blood spots that don't require identifying information. So that was really more. It was the issue of the purpose for surveillance.
Right.
That's a worthwhile comment.
Okay. So you want us to do what? To that.
You could even just mention it as a
just
sentence.
Point out that those exactly. activities can be done using anonymized.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
And that's also, I think, the issue and comment number 5 from the CDC. So if we make that change to on page 7, will that help?
Yes.
Okay. And that's it. from the CDC.
Michelle. I couldn't even find that in the briefing, that big briefing book.
Yeah, any more comments from the this is obviously a very important document. It's been percolating through the system for a very long time. And so I think that having gotten the public comments and so forth, and we want to be certain that people are comfortable with it, but we need to get it out. We need to send it to the secretary, and we also would want to publish this, obviously. Roger?
Thank you. My question may have just been addressed by Colleen's comment, but I just want to be sure. The one thing that really jumped out to me as a surprise in the new changes was the listing of development of new tests as an other rather than a standard use. The use of anonymized residual blood specimens in the development and validation of new tests, in my opinion, is a very standard use. And if for some reason listing that as an other use had implications that interfered with the growth and development of new tests, I think that would be a concern. So I just wanted to point that out. But it could be that when you address this concept of anonymized, then my concern will be fine.
Are there further comments about the paper for Alyssa?
Can I just ask one further question? And this was on number 4 in the recommendation on page 25. I'm going to ask this of Jeff and Alan in terms of just our ethical legal issues here. When I read the actual recommendation, particularly the latter part of it, and I'll read it out loud for everybody, is if residual blood specimens are to be available for any purpose other than the legally required newborn screening process for which they were obtained, all state newborn screening programs should document parents' wishes, awareness, and willingness to participate in compliance with federal research requirements. And then the explanation, I guess the second part of that explanation, the second sentence, maybe I'm missing the point here. It doesn't feel like it supports that latter part of that statement. It says, once the use of residual newborn screening specimens moves beyond state mandated and related standard program uses, each state should consider whether separate or blanket consent descent processes for approved studies is required from parents, legal guardians, or individuals screened for the use of residual newborn screening specimens. So I feel like those say two very different things, and maybe I'm just not getting the last part of that recommendation in compliance with federal research regulations or requirements. And maybe
because
it's just me.
Federal research regulations wouldn't always require consent if they're anonymized, for example. If you go back to the briefing paper, the Office of Human Research Protections actually defines when consent would actually be needed. And if your samples are anonymized, that was one of their points they made to us in their earlier comments, where they made those distinctions. I think that's why the recommendation was written the way it was, because it's a thoughtful process for the state to decide, you know, is this a case where consent should be obtained, or after looking at federal regulations, do we need to obtain consent? And even if federal regulations might not require, you know, would it be politically best to go through a process of consent? So it becomes the individual state and or researchers sort of weighing some of those issues in the context of what is required, I think. That's why we worded it the way we did.
If other people feel comfortable with it, I'm okay. It just feels a little bit.
Alan?
I think that both Colleen and Michelle are correct, and that we could word this better so that we could clarify.
Can I hear what she's
because
saying?
I think it can be read as Colleen is concerned, but it should be read as Michelle has argued. So I think perhaps Jeff and I over lunch could quickly try to just fix that a little, without changing the intent at all.
Okay.
Thank you.
That would be great.
Or if Jeff has already done it, maybe he's got it done.
Well, quick comment. I think I see the problem, and I do see this. The body of the recommendation itself is setting a higher standard than what the federal regulations require.
Right.
And if we wish to do that, that's fine. But we should be aware that that's where this is going.
It's to allow some, because you may want to do that.
Right. I think what we need to do is craft language which says it must be consistent with federal research requirements at a minimum. It must consider whether or not it's appropriate to document parents' wishes, and the state has the right to make that judgment, and awareness and willingness to participate. I mean, I think we just need to craft the language so that the states will know they have to be consistent at a minimum with the federal regulations, but they have the option then to discuss these concerns and adjudicate how they want to do that. Is that, Jeff, consistent with what you're saying? So, I mean, I think that's where the clarification needs to occur.
Aside from this one point of clarification, is the committee comfortable with this document as it now reads? Jeff, you have additional comment?
Well, just real quick, one of the things I think the document does pretty well, but the IOM roundtable does a little bit better, is just talks about the benefits of research. We're doing a study now talking to lots of folks around the country about this specific issue, and one of the striking outcomes so far is that members of the general public cannot describe what the benefits are of research. They can tell you what risks are. They make stuff up, and they come up with a list of risks, but they can't tell you what the benefits are. So I think having an opportunity to really tell folks why this is important. And again, I think it's pretty good now, so it's just a general comment. If there's ways to strengthen that a little bit.
You have specific suggestions about how to do that?
Well, and again, I think the IOM document is I think it's Ann Como's work there that's very impressive. So maybe just a reference or, I don't have a specific recommendation, so I apologize. Maybe late in the game for that then.
Well, we just received the summary from the IOM. So that's what I said in the beginning when I spoke, that Ann's comments in particular, I thought we should try to incorporate, because she gives some detailed examples of how that state specifically used them. So I did want to, if the committee agrees, expand on that section. Great. Using some of the specific comments from the IOM study, workshop summary, and reference that.
Well, the NIH recommendations were quite specific in trying to emphasize the value of research in these with this material, and so I think now, do we have too many changes to vote on this at the current time? What's the sense of the group? Most of the changes I've heard are wording changes. Denise?
Well, I had one more question, and I don't know if it was included in changes. So I guess the answer to your first question is yes, it would be nice for us to see the changes in a single document. But there was a recommendation that the committee facilitate a dialogue among all the relevant stakeholders on this issue. And I guess if I were the secretary or the secretary's staff, what I would be looking for is some outcome from that dialogue or some time frame around doing that so that the issues at least have a chance of being resolved to the extent that they can.
Can you suggest changes to that specific recommendation number 7?
Let me see. Do you know what page it's on?
It's on page 26.
Okay.
While Denise is contemplating her changes, Sharon, do you have a comment? Okay.
What if we add at the end, it says administrative support and funding should be provided to this committee to facilitate this dialogue and develop this guidance. This activity should be, because it's dependent on funding, it's hard to put a timeline, but we could say that a report should be delivered to the secretary.
Within 2 years.
Within 2 years.
Yeah, okay. But okay. I thought there was another change that got rid of this request for funding and just said that the committee
It was reordered to make the request for funding not the focal point, to make the focal point that there should be a dialogue and then add the funding request after that. So, and that was just, and NIH thought it might be
the we need to move this document along, and I guess the question is, do the committee feel, as Denise, that you'd like to see the final wording of these? Are you comfortable that Alan and Jeff can make these changes and we can put the IOM stuff in there, and you would be comfortable with that without seeing how it actually looks? Jerry?
I would. I think these are minor changes, and they're wordsmithing only. They're not going to change the intent. We all agree on the intent.
Is the sentiment similar from the committee?
I guess it would be nice. I agree, but it would be nice if when those changes are made, we could at least get an information copy.
Oh, well, you clearly will have. The bottom line, these are minor changes. They will incorporate some data from the really very nice IOM report that Adam, as we mentioned earlier, provided the committee. And so we'll make those changes. Jeff and Alan will be able to make theirs promptly, and the IOM stuff can be added and so forth. Having heard that, there are two issues here. One is to send the report to the secretary, and the second is to have it published as a report of the secretary and submitted likely to Genetics and Medicine. Can we have a motion for the first part of that, and that is to accept this and send to the secretary?
So moved.
Jerry? And Becky, those favoring that, say, raise your hand. Any opposition? And did
can
anybody?
Can I ask a question? Can we see it before it goes to the secretary?
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It would. I would think that these changes should be made promptly, and they could be sent to you electronically, and you'll have a very brief. One of the problems is that when things go to you electronically, most people's email seems to be down for the month when you get it. But anyway, if you have a comment, it'll have to be done promptly and so forth.
Just give a deadline and basically a form that basically says that if we don't hear from you in
with
whatever
week,
time you need,
a week after you get the thing
elected. We assume your consent.
We assume that you're comfortable with the wording and so forth. So we've had a motion. You've had a motion and a second to accept and send forward to the secretary, and I saw no opposition to that. Now, the second is to publish the document as a report from the committee. Is there a motion for that?
Sure. So moved.
Second.
And those favoring it? Any opposition? Any abstentions? Thank you very much. We're delighted that this document is in English. It's been around so long that it might have been introduced in an ancient tongue, but anyway, I think it's a good document, and I think it will be very helpful in forwarding the dialogue and so forth.
We did translate some Danish in this last round.
Oh, good! Excellent.
On the phone.
Excellent. Bent Peterson's very good with his English. Michelle has some burning issue.
I'm sorry. Could Brad Farrell actually speak to the, or actually Alan could, either one, to the work group's proposed design for this publication? Because it isn't going to be, they proposing not to have a duplication of the actual briefing paper sent forward to the secretary, but to actually do some analysis of the recommendations, right?
We are.
Well, that's what Don Bailey.
We work at the prerogative of the committee, so the discussion had been with the committee, with our working group, writing something a little bit more condensed that would be more amenable to publication. But either way you want to go, I mean, the working group, two members are here, Sharon and Alan, and on the group, and then there's more of us in the audience. So whatever you want to do, we'll do.
Well, on the phone, you had some specific recommendations. For instance, with the recommendations, you wanted to do an analysis of why those recommendations were being put forward. That was Don Bailey's suggestion.
Yeah, I don't recall that. So, but Don was.
It's in my notes.
Don is happy to work with us and do whatever we want to do. So.
Here comes one of the historical workers on this document, Harry Hannon.
Don's suggestion was that we take each of the recommendations and go back into the document and pull the information that supported those recommendations in the aspect of constructing a condensed document so that the reader could understand the information that went or contributed to the creation of each recommendation.
So it's more of a formatting thing than it was an analysis?
Well, it's a content. Yeah.
So it is lunchtime, and let me make a comment about lunch, and that is that those of you who remember having lunch in this hotel before, the audience went upstairs to the restaurant, which overwhelmed the restaurant, and folks did not get served before 3 in the afternoon. So at the front desk, they have a list of some of the area places nearby where you're more likely to get served briskly and get back for our 1 o'clock time frame. So let's go to lunch and we'll start talking about CLIAC at 1 o'clock. Thank you.